Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks very much for listening on Friday, April 24th, 2015. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. And this week, expert number one is Dan Blair, President and CEO of the National Academy of Public Administration. Pull that mic up on you nice and close, Dan. Thank you very much for being here today. It's great to see you, my friend, as always.
Well, thank you, Francis. It's good to be here.
And I'm the second expert today. We had another friend of ours lined up to join us today, and he was unable to because of a last-minute commitment. So I've chosen three federal news stories that I think are the most important of the week. You've chosen three. And just in case you were wondering who the gentleman is that's walking in and out. Now, our air conditioning in the studio has not been functioning for the last 3 days. So it's about right now, I think, what does it say over there? 86, I think.
That's a comfortable 86.
And yeah, that's right. It's nice and sunny. Well, I'm glad that you got my email in time that it was fine for you to wear your bathing suit.
Uh-huh.
At any rate, Keith is coming in and out from time to time from the HVAC company and wants to see what's going on in here. Because this room and a couple of the other studios are separate from the rest of the air conditioning in the rest of the building. So he's going to be in and out just to check on things.
Understood.
So if I don't want him to throw you off as we count down the stories.
But I this way I can refrain from describing my new bathing suit for your viewers.
That's really, and
listeners.
People will notice that there will be no photos of
that's
the countdown on the website this week. So we'll
and
start.
That's a good thing.
Yes, it's a great thing. We'll start where we always do with
number three.
And your choice for the third most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Post. The headline is, Florida mailman lands a gyrocopter on Capitol lawn hoping to send a message. Now, I thought of you, I have to say, when I first heard about this story that
that's
this guy
disturbing.
Was from the Postal Service
you
because
of
your experience on the Rate Commission.
Well, Regulatory Commission.
I'm sorry. I still call the GAO the Government Accounting
since
Office.
2006.
Thank you.
Okay.
But that's okay. But that's why I thought of you. What struck you about the story of Doug Hughes?
Well, I'll tell you, it's, you know, first you see the story and you want to just kind of laugh because it's so absurd until you start scratching beneath it. And it's just absolutely horrible. I mean, this story just really bothered me on so many levels. First, you have an incident of a gentleman who's a public servant, a mailman, who had who experienced a horrific loss with his son's suicide, and was distraught. And then you hear about then he picks up a public issue of campaign finance reform, which everyone can applaud. Everyone has strong feelings on that. But then he tells a reporter in Tampa what he's going to do, and then he flies his gyrocopter down the mall and ends up, you know, landing it on the lawn of the Capitol without any interference whatsoever. I mean, had you know, bless his heart, and I feel badly for him, but he should have been shot down. I mean, we had that incident of the man in the tractor from North Carolina here. What was that? 12 years ago, 13 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and he you know made these threats, and they ended up you know killing him. And you just look at this and go, but for the grace of God, he was not. But the other thing that horrified me was the reporter knew about it and didn't do anything about it, and reported on it. I mean, it sounds like you know it's TMZ writ large.
Mm-hmm.
But it also raises where I see a public administration issue is where were our defenses in place? I mean, this crossed over multiple jurisdictions. And he was still free to do this. I remember I was a Senate staffer for 4 years before joining the Bush administration. And my last day in the United States Senate working on what was in the Governmental Affairs Committee was when they shut it down for anthrax.
Mm-hmm.
And this just reminds me, he could have been, you know, had this been someone else with a nefarious purpose, he could have been spreading, you know, anthrax down the mall, any kind of other, you know, God only knows what else, or he could have had a dirty bomb. And so it shows you that it raises questions of our homeland defenses and capabilities. And it's to me, on first blush, it appeals to the cynic in me because I think it's kind of funny here this guy from Tampa flies a mini airplane on the lawn of the Capitol, but you scratch beneath the surface, and it really concerns me about, you know, where are we in terms of our homeland security.
The issue that the part of this that is most striking to me is it fits with a narrative that I know is going on inside the Defense Department, which is we have these huge, powerful weapons and capabilities. And yet, for example, in Iraq, they struggled with mechanisms with IEDs that people were making out of essentially out of stuff they found laying around. And that was a lot harder for the Defense Department, for the forces to defend against than another big army coming at us. You know, that we were well prepared for. This story says, in a statement, a Federal Aviation Administration spokeswoman said Hughes, the pilot, was not in contact with FAA air traffic controllers, and the FAA did not authorize him to enter restricted airspace. Well, of course not, because that's not what his deal was. He was intentionally trying to not do that. And probably, if we got him the truth out of him, probably never even occurred to him to let anybody know other than the people that he told. I mean, he wasn't thinking about safety authorities through any of this.
Well, I thought the better response was the NORAD spokesman who said, we're trying to determine why, but I can say we did not scramble assets. What does that mean? I mean, to me, that's the worst response possible. You scramble together a number of words which most people wouldn't understand, mm-hmm. and as a way of a nonsensical response, meaning that, no, we didn't do anything about it. This does raise concerns, and you bring up a really valid point of it's the most low-tech weapon that could prove to be the most destructive, and that those are things that we need to think about and defend against.
I don't believe the authorities are going to shoot down a 60-year-old mailman in a flying bicycle, Hughes said in a video that appeared on the Tampa Bay Times website shortly before he landed.
Well, bless his heart, but they should have. The authorities took out he was a 62-year-old farmer from North Carolina that time. And so this, you know, he was making a political point, and I understand that. But the overall question is, he breached all these defenses. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know that this gentleman had good intentions. We had no way of knowing that. And our defenses didn't either, but our defenses did not rise to the occasion. And that's why this raises such a high level of concern.
One more troubling part of this. Hughes took off, the story says, from a location that he described only as being over an hour away from the no-fly zone, but which turned out to be the Gettysburg Regional Airport about 80 miles away. I wonder if everybody there who was there when this happened is going to be fired, because a guy takes off, he's wearing a Postal Service uniform, has a Postal Service logo on the side of this device, whatever you want to call it. And, I mean, doesn't that look a little, wouldn't you think that would look weird? You think somebody would go, what are you up to exactly, sir? And it doesn't appear that if anybody did, that anybody got any kind of an answer. And, of course, obviously nobody did anything about it.
Well, look at what happened with our defenses in 9/11. It wasn't a question of our enemies taking out our most sophisticated weapon systems. Mm-hmm. It was skyjackers with box cutters. I mean, how low tech can you get with something like that?
Yep.
So this again reemphasizes that it's that low tech weapon, and it's the individual who can pose the most serious threat.
The third most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Dan Blair, is from Federal News Radio. It's from the Washington Post, and the headline is: Florida mailman lands a gyrocopter on Capitol Lawn, hoping to send a message. My choice at number three is from federalnewsradio.com. New Pentagon strategy warns of cyber war capabilities. And we talked a little bit about this before we went on the air, and you made a very valid point, and that is that the news here is not that the Defense Department uses cyber weapons as to provide offensive capability. But the news is that this is the first time explicitly, publicly, that a very top, I mean, in this case, the top official at the Defense Department explicitly explains how that capability is possible and how it exists. I think that's tremendously significant.
Well, I think it's tremendously significant as well. It means that we really do have some very strong defenses and capabilities to keep our enemies at bay. I contrast this with the previous story of very low tech, low grade, and our defenses were let down. But on this area, this shows you that we really have the right stuff when it comes to this, to these kinds of IT technologies, solutions, and capabilities in defending our interests. I think this is good. I do think that this is, in many ways, confirming what most of us or many of us already knew or suspected. But it also sends, I think it's also a message. I mean, there's a message here, not to us, but to others, to say, we're confirming we have this.
Mm-hmm.
And then my question is, well, what else do we have that we don't know about?
Well, and that's a very wise observer told me many years ago that there's always something that you, meaning me and the media, there's always something you don't know that nobody's talked about yet. So this is then, this is now a generation or two behind
right.
the curve is what I would read into this. But this story says the 33-page strategy says the Defense Department, quote, should be able to use cyber operations to disrupt an adversary's command and control networks, military-related critical infrastructure, and weapons capabilities. And further down, it says that the reason they're putting this out now is the Pentagon wants more transparency in its cyber mission and because it could provide some deterrence to adversaries. And that's always the ultimate goal, it seems to me, of most weapons capabilities is you build something hoping that you don't have to use it.
Right, and you wonder who the audience is for this.
I know exactly who the audience for it is, I think. I think the audience for it is Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping.
It's not us.
Yeah.
But what I also find interesting in here, and I don't see it, is they talk about this 33-page strategy, but is it still classified? And is it available publicly? If they're talking about transparency and making their strategies more public, is there a link to this? I don't know. But I think that that would be interesting to see, too, if this 33-page report is a public report or is it still a classified report?
The 33-page strategy, it was released at the same time, or the information about it, released at the same time that Secretary Carter, this story says, uncovered a breach by Russian hackers into an unclassified defense computer network earlier this year. Officials were able to identify the intruders within 24 hours and kick them out. So that's my one reason for saying this is directed at Putin, but I also think it's directed at Xi Jinping, the leader in China, because DOD officials and others in the government have said for a long time that China is the biggest perpetrator of cyber attacks against the federal government's networks.
Well, they even identified the building, I think, in Shanghai where it was.
Yeah, that Mandiant report from last spring. The third most important federal news story of the week, according to me, is from federalnewsradio.com. New Pentagon strategy warns of cyber capabilities. The second most important federal news stories of the week with me and Dan Blair. When we come back on the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose. On Federal News Radio, the Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, selected this week by myself and by Dan Blair, the National Academy of Public Administration, and we're up to
number two.
And Dan, your choice at number two is my colleague Sean McCauley's story from federalnewsradio.com titled Do's and Don'ts of Social Media for Federal Employees. And it's the essence of it is Office of Government Ethics has a new standards of conduct guide for social media use. And on the one hand, you think, well, a lot of this is probably common sense. On the other hand, you think, well, it must not be, or it wouldn't have been necessary for OGE to come out with some guideline to this.
Well, I think that's precisely on point. For OG to come out with formal guidelines, they've had to have some issues, and this must have come up in a suitability background check or with others using too much time on Facebook. It references Facebook specifically and how you need to make an honest effort to only perform work functions during work hours. But it also raises the broader question of social media and federal employment and how that interacts. And are there things that you're doing on social media that could disqualify you, not just in terms of a security clearance, but also impact your job and your ability to do your job? We've been dealing with this now for what, maybe 15 years?
About that, yeah.
I remember, I'm old enough, I'm revealing my age, but I started in the workplace just before email arrived. And when I first was on the Hill, email was internal to the Hill, then it expanded. But from the get-go, we were always told, be careful about what you put in email, because everything you put in email, you should make sure that it's suitable for the front page of the Washington Post.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems that the millennials grew up in a much different environment. They grew up in this environment of where this was commonplace. I mean, the sense of privacy between a baby boomer and a millennial, I think, is 180 degrees.
I agree.
Because we value privacy. We remember George Orwell's 1984. We remember a time when we thought 1984 was a long distance from us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was a book you read in high school. And so to me, the idea that you would put that you post things of a personal nature and leave them on the web is something that and for everyone to see is something that I normally wouldn't do. But I think for a 25-year-old, they grew up in an environment where it's much different. So this is very instructive from that perspective. It's also instructive from the perspective of a security clearance. There was something else that I read earlier that that they look at in getting there is a question of whether or not they're going to formally look into your social media as part of the security clearance background.
Mm-hmm.
And that one of the things that they would look into is your contacts with foreign nationals. Well, I have a LinkedIn profile, and I have a number of folks that I've linked in who we have my organization, our members are called fellows. I have fellows from abroad. I have some from Korea. I have some from the EU. I have linked in with some elected officials in the EU as well. And you think this is part of a business network. But they said if you have foreign contacts in your social profile, it would raise a question. And that goes back to me, a fundamental issue. I'm like, wait a minute, I can talk to whoever I want to talk to. But that's not necessarily the case with the security clearance.
Mm-hmm.
And it raises issues of privacy. So I thought this was very interesting at bringing back home and, you know, reminding employees in the federal workplace that you need to be careful about your social media contacts and your social media use.
It also calls some attention to the idea of you representing your workplace, in this case, a federal agency. I've heard this, regarding social media, about me representing Federal News Radio and my colleagues here. You know, if I tweet something but the government's a little more sensitive about this. For example, employees, the story says, should also refrain from including their official titles on sites like Facebook, MySpace, or Zanga. I don't think anybody really has to worry about MySpace, by the way, but anyway, that's just me. OGE said including a title could accidentally imply a federal endorsement or sponsorship of some kind, or appear like an employee is using it for personal gain.
Well, I think you'd have to look at the context.
Yeah.
I think that's a little bit of a stretch.
Right.
Because on Facebook, if you put about, you know, you may post that, you know, you got a new job doing you landed a new job and that you're a senior executive of the department of blank, blank, blank. And that the people within your Facebook network would want to know about that, your friends, your family, your former, high school, college. And that to me is what I use Facebook for.
Uh-huh.
I rarely use my Facebook account, but my Facebook friends are all from high school and college for the most part. And I don't use it for a professional reason. But it raises interesting issues. And I think that as more and more sites abound and in a year or two, we're going to be looking at our watches and checking our, and we could be checking our Facebook site at the
mm-hmm.
same time. You know, as technology evolves, this is going to become a larger issue in addressing this, balancing the need to know what employees, especially those holding security clearances, are doing versus respecting their rights and privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, I see the idea of privacy just, you know, being diminished, diminished, and diminished. Hopefully this is a pendulum and sometime it'll swing, but I don't know, because you can't walk down the street of Washington, D.C. today without being on camera someplace.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's just the brave new world we're living in, but I think that George Orwell would have had something to say about that.
So the element of this, too, that I'm not sure we've pulled the whole thread out of is, all right, let's say I'm on LinkedIn and I write on LinkedIn my correct official legitimate title, deputy, assistant, undersecretary, whatever, and or just plain old, I don't know, project manager or something like that, department of fill in the blank. And in a strictly, completely innocent, innocuous way, I link to a news story about, a presidential candidate. I can understand where somebody at my agency might be a little bit queasy about the fact that I have noted this. Even that's a case where context would be very difficult to ascertain. There are so many wrinkles and potential complications here. I can understand. That's why I said at the beginning, it appears on the surface this is all common sense, but there's a lot more to it as you dig down into it.
Well, it's if you like something or not on Facebook.
Right.
So what happens if you like Hillary Clinton's campaign?
Mm-hmm.
Is that an endorsement?
Or even if you like an event that somebody, some political figure is speaking at or something like that. I don't know.
You know,
TV show. I don't know.
Does that violate the Hatch Act? Does it violate the Hatch Act if you've done it on official time?
Yeah.
You know, you can do things under the Hatch Act. You can participate in, or most federal employees can participate in the political process off duty as long as they don't bring in, you know, they don't do it in an official uniform or on official time.
Mm-hmm.
But if you like it, and what happens if you're viewing the web page or you're viewing the web page or presenting a blog or something and you're doing it in the workspace. It raises all kinds of questions. And then, you know, what happens if you like something that tends to be controversial?
Mm-hmm.
What happens, you know, where does your First Amendment right come in here? You may like something that everyone else may be appalled by. Is it, you know, maybe 10 years ago you might have liked, there might have been a site that was devoted to promoting gay and lesbian and bisexual transgender unions. You know, you're pro gay marriage and you like that. Would that have gotten you in trouble in the workplace if your supervisor was a social conservative and didn't like that? It just raises a bunch of sticky issues. I think that most of the time common sense should prevail, but it's not common sense that these days that drives public policy. It's usually the exception to the rule. And that's why we find ourselves in trouble at times.
Dan Blair's second most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com, Do's and Don'ts of Social Media for Federal Employees. And you can read that and all the stories on this week's countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. My choice at number two is also from federalnewsradio.com. IRS should get spending in order before asking for a larger budget, House says. And my colleague Jory Heckman writing about the House Ways and Means Committee deciding that there is still plenty of work for John Koskinen, the commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service, to do before the Ways and Means Committee believes he can honestly say, we've cut everything that we can cut, and so we need more money in order to provide better service. As I read down through this, though, I think I can see both sides of it. One of the things that they talk about is employee bonuses, and they said you should stop paying bonuses, and that money could go toward providing better customer service. My understanding of the collective bargaining agreement that's in place between NTEU and the Internal Revenue Service is not that simple, and that's an issue that I know you know a fair amount more about than I do, Dan.
Well, I don't know the specifics on this.
Of course.
But normally I would say I agree with the premise that the agency should cut everything it can in order to provide the customer service. And where it has discretion, it should focus on those items or those activities and programs that are customer-centric. I fully support that. But at the same time, what kind of message are you sending? Are you being, what is it, penny wise and pound foolish if you cut employee incentive pay? What incentive is there for employees to improve customer service or take that extra mile that might be required in order to give good service? I'm not always sure that that's the right case. This is a tough one for me because I am one of the biggest fans of Commissioner Koskinen. I remember he did incredible work. He was well-respected on both sides when he was the Deputy Director for Management at OMB during the Clinton administration. He was highly respected for his work on Y2K, and I commend him for his public service because taking on this agency in this environment was not for those who had a weak stomach. And I think that he is a tremendous public servant. But I also raise questions about, you know, it's, you know, official, you know, we're paying all this money for official time. And are there ways that the IRS can cut? I do know that they were questioning him, I believe it was in a, I can't remember if it was an appropriations hearing this week or earlier, but they were saying that he admitted, he said, we have legal mandates that we have to follow. And those legal mandates require us to spend the money in this way. If you change the legal mandates, then we can provide more money the other way. So I'm not sure he has as much discretion as what the committee might like, or someone on the committee might attribute to him. But he readily admitted that the customer service levels this time around were not what they should
be. Well, and he started with this back in November or December.
I mean, he has not in any way tried to cover it up. Actually, he's been at the forefront of it, saying, you know, he didn't say horrible, but people have to wait 30, 45 minutes for a live person. And mm-hmm. then he said that was my words, but I got from him, it was unacceptable. So he certainly understands the problem. I think if, you know, he seems to be an individual of goodwill, and I think that if we can find those in Congress of goodwill, I think there could be a solution to this.
My second most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. IRS should get spending in order before asking for larger budget. House says that, and all of our stories in the countdown linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week on this week's Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by my friend Dan Blair, the President and CEO of the National Academy of Public Administration, and by yours truly. And we are up to
number one.
And Dan, your choice as the most important federal news story of the week is from Joe Davidson at the Washington Post. And the headline is Good News About Feds Doing Important Work and Saving Money. I missed this last night. It's the Senior Executives Association's annual ball. It's a huge deal. It's fantastic. Joe writes, a group of senior federal employees saved Uncle Sam an estimated $32 billion while doing some pretty important work. They were honored with a black tie banquet Thursday evening in the State Department's elegant diplomatic reception rooms. This is impressive stuff, and I think with the exception of people like us, Joe, the other organizations that report on the federal space exclusively, nobody ever hears about any of this stuff.
Well, I wanted this to be the story of the week because this is a good news story. This is a story about people performing outstanding work for the United States and for America. Start off with a story which, you know, I kind of held up for ridicule, our homeland security defenses.
Mm-hmm.
But I did that on purpose because I wanted to end with this, a very positive story. When I was at OPM, I oversaw the program. And I have to tell you that it just really blows your socks off what some of these officials do. And they do it every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the more we reward and recognize them, the more that we elevate the level of public service and discourse about the public service in our country. I find it interesting that even with a good news story, there is always this little, like, you know, yeah.
There's always something.
End. There's always this, you know, little jab at the end. And it's that, you know, we don't have, Joe pointed out that the number of awards has gone down since 2009. I don't know what that means. I don't know if that's a deliberate effort. If it is, I don't know why. I don't know if those who are judging this picked out those that they thought were really, truly deserving of the award. I don't know. I do know, though, that we didn't recognize these folks. What was it, in 2013?
I believe that's correct.
And why we didn't recognize those folks is beyond me. This is not a budget issue. I know that some thought it didn't look right to be rewarding these executives with these awards when agencies were facing sequestration or even the shutdown, although all the employees got paid. I'm like, you recognize outstanding service when it occurs. You
mm-hmm.
know, you don't allow other outside factors to prevent you from doing it. And I'm very, very glad to see it done this year. Kudos to SEA for doing this. I was unable to go last night. I've gone almost every year over the last 12 years, and it is just an amazing ceremony. And I was planning on going. I'm really sorry I wasn't able to be there, but congratulations to all those, the distinguished and meritorious award winners, despite there might be fewer of them, but it even makes it even more special than if there are fewer than it has been in the past. I don't know why there were, but I don't think that should detract or in any way diminish the award and the recognition due these distinguished executives.
I would love to go to this event one year, and as I read about it each year, I'm always reminded of the Service to America medals, that it's the same caliber of people that you see at each that are just the cream of the crop and the kinds of folks that make you go, okay, how do we get more of them? And how do we keep more of them to continue to do this kind of work?
And I think the SAMMYs are an incredible award ceremony. And I think that the recognition that they give to federal employees doing great things for the country should be highlighted, and they are. I think more needs to be done about recognizing these award winners. But to me, these are people who for the overwhelmingly most part, have devoted their lives to federal service. So to me, recognizing them for specific duties, but also there's an element of a body of work, so to speak. And I think that these are even more special because it recognizes really the best of the best. And you've really risen to a level, and you're recognized not only by the president, but by your peers. And I think that is a tremendous incentive.
The numbers cited in Joe's column in the Washington Post, 0.34% of top-level civil servants for the top honor in 2014, 1.27 for the meritorious title, according to SEA, 76 distinguished, 268 meritorious winners in 2009. And he writes, OMB would not explain the decline. Maybe there's no explanation for the decline.
We don't know. I don't know what the judges did. I don't know if they thought that this year that these were truly deserving and others didn't quite rate up there. I don't know. I can't speak for them. But let's not try to detract from those that actually did do it. And I think that, you know, let's give them the honor and privilege. Let's give them a day in the sun in recognition.
Dan Blair's choice as the most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Post. Good news about feds doing important work and saving money. And you can read it and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news story of the week is selected by yours truly. It's next on In-Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by yours truly and by Dan Blair of the National Academy of Public Administration. And my choice at number one this week, Dan, is a story that just went up on federalnewsradio.com late in the afternoon yesterday. And the headline is, Boehner says okay to swap agency budget boosts for other cuts. I didn't write the headline, and I'm not sure about the headline, but what the story says is that the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, is saying publicly that he is open to another deal, like the bipartisan budget agreement, commonly known as the Murray-Ryan plan, almost 2 years ago, to remove the threat of sequestration from the federal government. Now, he doesn't specify, would it be a two-year deal? Would it be a long-term thing? The people that I've talked to from the Hill expect that it will look very similar to what we saw with Murray Ryan, or I guess we should do Ryan Murray every other time we talk about it, reverse it, right, to give equal time. But at any rate, the bipartisan budget agreement looks like it'll be the framework for this, whatever comes out. But I'm continue to be very encouraged, maybe more encouraged than I should be, by some of the things that are coming out of this Congress regarding the budget and the potential progress that's being made. Now, we'll learn more on Monday about how much progress the House is making on, they're expected to introduce two appropriations bills on the floor. This is the middle of April, or end of April. I mean, this is, yes, according to the law, it's right on time, but I can't remember the last time that we saw two bills on the floor ready to go with a negotiated budget conference report resolution. I mean, we're seeing stuff that we haven't seen in a long time is what I'm getting at, and I think it bodes well for the rest of the fiscal year.
Francis,
am I seeing stars?
You're so old school. I say that jokingly because I think this is, you know, you try to find good news in today's stories. And I think this is one. You know, I wouldn't pop the champagne corks yet and say we've reached a new bipartisan era.
No, I agree.
But this is on the road to actually having a functioning Congress. Have pragmatists won the day. I wouldn't say they've won, but at least things are starting, you know, the process is working as it should and is starting to work again. We've had the last 4 years have just been stagnant, where it's just been constant gridlock, and it hasn't been good for the country. I think there's a lot of self-preservation at play here as well. I think Republicans desperately need to show that they can govern. Congressional Democrats need to desperately show their relevance. And the president needs to show something for his last 2 years in office. So I think self-preservation is an amazing incentive. And self-preservation may be kicking in here to see where can we find that common ground. Hopefully they'll find a common ground in a lot more areas. But I would also point out, you know, we found that common ground last year in December when they passed the so-called Cromnibus.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone, when they went out for the elections in October, all the pundits around town were saying, it's going to be a CR, it's going to be a CR, it's going to be a CR. And I heard from some of our sources saying, they may be striking a deal because the staff's being told to quietly work these things. And lo and behold, for a number of the appropriation bills they did, they were included in that Cromnibus. And it's time Congress step up and start doing its job, but it's also time Congress step up and say, hey, wait a minute. Every time they do a CR, they might as well take a bucket and load their jurisdictional concerns in the Congress and ship them off to the executive branch and say, here, unelected bureaucrats, you do our job because mm-hmm. we can't do ours. And at some point, I'm glad to see a realization coming on board saying, wait a minute, we have a role here in the public policy. We have a role to set this public policy, and let's get going. So I hope this bodes well for a productive appropriation season as well.
The timeline is, we're still in pretty good shape timeline-wise.
We're in very good shape.
The House is out, I think, about half of May. It's not sequential, but then they're here for almost all of June, and with the exception of the Independence Day holiday, almost all of July.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole lot of work time coming up in the next 3 months, two of the next 3 months. Congress is here pretty much the whole time, and so the potential, if we continue apace based on what we've seen, the potential exists that we could get to the August recess with at least some bills already on President Obama's desk.
Well, I think that would be reminiscent of the old days, and I think it would show that Congress can indeed work. I think on both the House and the Senate, I think the leadership needs to demonstrate that they can govern and that this fits that pattern.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think that is good for American democracy and for the country at large that we have a functioning Congress. And the question is going to be, is when will the political season begin again that stops all this? Traditionally, in a presidential election year, everything shut down around June.
Mm-hmm.
The June to maybe July, but by July it was all presidential politics
right.
of the election year. And so we still have, we're in April of the preceding year, so maybe they can be productive through the fall and maybe through the early part of the winter. I think that's very optimistic on my part, but we'll see. And we'll see, you know, at what point Congress shuts down and turns to presidential politics and trying to pass legislation that way. Maybe the strategy is let's find the areas of common ground now because
mm-hmm.
we know we're going to hit there. So let's get the things that we need to get done now, and that way we can clear the floor for our partisan battles.
It may be, you may be right. Maybe this year, you know, again, maybe I'm too optimistic, but I'm thinking it could be different this year. The reason that I say that is because if you remember the day after the election back in November, some of the firebrands on the Republican side were saying, well, this proves that we're the electorate thinks we're right about Obamacare and all. They had their laundry list of stuff. And a couple of people that I really trust their political instincts on the Republican side said, I hope that's not what the leadership decides they want to do. Because the people that I really respected that watched the results of that election said this was about competence and ability. This was not about one side right or the other. This was a perception that people had that Congress was not functioning well, and they wanted to do something to change the way that Congress functioned. And what I see in this story is that recognition.
Well, and also the midterm electorate is much different than the presidential year electorate. I shouldn't say much different, but it's different than the presidential year electorate. And that's why you see a change.
My most important federal news story of the week is Boehner says okay to swap agency budget boosts for other cuts. It's from federalnewsradio.com, and all those stories from today's program linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Dan Blair, the National Academy of Public Administration, my guest in the program. It's wonderful, as always, to have you here.
Well,
thanks,
Francis,
very much for doing it.
I like the one-on-one. I like the attention. Let's do it again.
I don't know. I can't guarantee that, but I appreciate you being here, and the Federal News Countdown returns next Friday on In-Depth with Francis Rose.
WFED Washington, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTLP FM HD2 Braddock Heights Frederick, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy Athletics.